movies with my friends John McClure, George McKelvey, and his wife Carol. We were going to see Mel Brooks's The Producers, and we decided to smoke a little pot, which had become a dietary staple for me. So now I was high. In the car on the way to the theater, I felt my mind being torn from its present location and lifted into the ether. My discomfort intensified, and I experienced an eerie distancing from my own self that crystallized into morbid doom. I mutely waited for the feeling to pass. It didn't, and I finally said, "I feel strange." We got out of the car, and John, George, and Carol walked me along Sunset Boulevard in the night. I decided to go into the theater, thinking it might be distracting. During the film, I sat in stoic silence as my heart began to race above 200 beats per minute and the saliva drained from my mouth so completely that I could not move my tongue. I assumed this was the heart attack I had been waiting for, though I wasn't feeling pain. I was, however, experiencing extreme fear. I thought I was dying, and I can't explain to you why I just sat there. After the movie, I considered checking myself into a hospital, but if I went to a hospital, I would miss work the next day, which might make me expendable at CBS, where my career was just launching. My friends walked me along Sunset again, and I remember humming, "Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune," from The King and I. I spent the night on George and Carol's couch in absolute terror. I kept wondering, am I dying, but was more concerned with the question, do I have to quit my job? I survived the night and struggled into work the next morning. I was not relieved, but I was calmer. I confessed to Bob Einstein what had happened, and found that as soon as I discussed the symptoms, they arose again with full intensity. However, I somehow maintained my implacable facade. The cycle was unbreakable. Any relief was followed by the worry of recurrence, which itself provoked the symptoms. After a few weeks, a list of triggers developed. I couldn't go back into a movie theater, and I didn't for at least 10 years. I never smoked pot again or got involved in the era's preoccupation with illicit substances. I'm sure this event helped me avoid the scourge of cocaine. However, the worst trigger was a certain event that, cruelly, happened every day. It was night. Eventually, I could find my way through the daytime, but as I left work, winding my way up the canyon streets as the sun set, I imagined feeling the slight rise in elevation and the air getting thinner. Nuts, I know. As a teenager, I had mixed a somber home life with a jubilant life away from the house. Now, I could be funny, alert, and involved while nursing internal chaos, believing that death was inching near with each eroding episode of terror. I learned over the next few months that I could do several things at once, be a comedy writer, be a stand-up comedian, and endure private, mortal fear. Thankfully, after a difficult year, my specific dread of nightfall faded. I suppose I was too practical to have such an inconvenient phobia. I discovered there was a name for what was happening to me. Reading medical and psychology books, I found my symptoms exactly described and named as an anxiety attack. I felt a sense of relief from the simple understanding that I was not alone. I read that these panic attacks were not dangerous, just gravely unpleasant. The symptoms were comparable to the biological changes the body experiences when put in danger, as if you were standing in front of an object of fear, such as an unleashed lion. In an anxiety attack, you have all of the symptoms of fear, yet there is no lion. I could not let self-doubt or lack of talent caused me to fail at this new writing job, this lion, which was the gateway to my next life as an entertainer. I carefully buried this fear. I was in over my head, but my conscious mind wouldn't allow that thought to exist, and my body rebelled that night in the movie theater. At least, this is my 10-cent diagnosis. I continued to suffer the attacks while I went on with my work, refusing to let this inner nightmare affect my performing or writing career. Though panic attacks are gone from my life now, they receded as slowly as the ice around Greenland. They were woven throughout 2 decades of my life. When I think of the moments of elation I have experienced over some of my successes, I am astounded at the number of times they have been accompanied by elation's hellish opposite. In the late 60s, comedy was in transition. The older school told jokes and stories, punctuated with the drummer's rim shot. Of the new school, Bill Cosby, one of the first to tell stories you actually believed were true, and Bob Newhart, who startled everyone with innovative low-key delivery and original material, had achieved icon status. A few years earlier, Von Meter, a skilled impressionist whose specialty was the First Family, had been nullified by JFK's assassination. George Carlin and Richard Pryor, though very funny, were still a few years away from their final artistic breakthroughs. Lenny Bruce had died several years earlier, fighting both the system and drugs, and his work was already in revival because of his caustic brilliance that made authority nervous. Vietnam, the first televised war, split the country, and one's left or right bent could be recognized by haircuts and clothes. The country was angry, and so was comedy, which was addressed to insiders. Cheech and Chong spoke to the expanding underground by rolling the world's largest doobie on film. There were exceptions. Don Rickles seemed to glide over the generation gap with killer appearances on The Tonight Show, and Johnny Carson remained a gentle satirist while maintaining a nice glossary of naughty boy breast jokes. Tim Conway and Harvey Korman, two great comic sketch actors working for the affable genius Carol Burnett, were deeply funny. The television free-for-all called Laugh-In kept its sense of joy, thanks in part to Goldie Hawn's unabashed goofiness and producer George Slaughter's perceptive use of her screw-ups. But even that show had high political content. In general, however, a comedian in shackles for indecent language or a singer's arrest for obscene gestures thrilled the growing underground audience. Silliness was just not appropriate for hip culture. It was this circumstance that set the stage for my success 8 years later. In a college psychology class, I had read a treatise on comedy explaining that a laugh was formed when the storyteller created tension, then, with the punchline, released it. I didn't quite get the concept, nor do I still, but it stayed with me, and eventually sparked my second wave of insights. With conventional joke-telling, there's a moment when the comedian delivers the punchline, and the audience knows it's the punchline, and their response ranges from polite to uproarious. What bothered me about the formula was the nature of the laugh it inspired, a vocal acknowledgement that a joke had been told, like automatic applause at the end of a song. A skillful comedian could coax a laugh with tiny indicators, such as a vocal tick, Bob Hope's, but I want to tell you, or even a slight body shift. Jackie Leonard used to punctuate jokes by slapping his stomach with his hand. One night, watching him on The Tonight Show, I noticed that several of his punchlines had been unintelligible, and the audience had actually laughed at nothing but the cue of his hand slap. These notions stayed with me for months until they formed an idea that revolutionized my comic direction. What if there were no punchlines? What if there were no indicators? What if I created tension and never released it? What if I headed for a climax, but all I delivered was an anticlimax? What would the audience do with all that tension? Theoretically, it would have to come out sometime. But if I kept denying them the formality of a punchline, the audience would eventually pick their own place to laugh, essentially out of desperation. This type of laugh seemed stronger to me, as they would be laughing at something they chose, rather than being told exactly when to laugh. To test my idea, at my next appearance at the Ice House, I went on stage and began, "I'd like to open up with sort of a funny comedy bit. This has really been a big one for me. It's the one that put me where I am today. I'm sure most of you will recognize the title when I mention it. It's the nose on microphone routine. And it's always funny no matter how many times you see it." I leaned in and placed my nose in the mic for a few long seconds. Then I stopped and took several bows, saying, "Thank you very much." "That's it," they thought. Yes, that was it. The laugh came not then, but only after they realized I had already moved on to the next bit. Now that I assigned myself to an act without jokes, I gave myself a rule. Never let them know I was bombing. This is funny, you just haven't gotten it yet. If I wasn't offering punchlines, I'd never be standing there with egg on my face. It was essential that I never show doubt about what I was doing. I would move through my act without pausing for the laughs, as though everything were an aside. Eventually, I thought, The last would be playing catch-up to what I was doing. Everything would be delivered in passing, or the opposite, an elaborate presentation that climaxed in pointlessness. Another rule was to make the audience believe that I thought I was fantastic, that my confidence could not be shattered. They had to believe that I didn't care if they laughed at all, and that this act was going on with or without them. I was having trouble ending my show. I thought, why not make a virtue of it? I started closing with extended bowing, as though I heard heavy applause. I kept insisting that I needed to beg off. No, nothing, not even this ovation I am imagining, can make me stay. My goal was to make the audience laugh, but leave them unable to describe what it was that had made them laugh. In other words, like the helpless state of giddiness experienced by close friends tuned into each other's sense of humor, you had to be there. At least, that was the theory. And for the next 8 years, I rolled it up a hill like Sisyphus. My first reviews came in. One said, "This so-called comedian should be told that jokes are supposed to have punchlines." Another said I represented the most serious booking error in the history of Los Angeles music. Wait, I thought. Let me explain my theory. My job with the Smothers Brothers allowed me to move to the hippie center of Southern California, Laurel Canyon. In 1968, Laurel Canyon was considered by the in-crowd to be a nature reserve because of the presence of trees, even though the Democratic Los Angeles smog covered all areas. Joni Mitchell lived there, so did Carole King, so did Kenny Loggins and Frank Zappa. I never met any of them, but I did reconnect with the person who, for the next 15 years, would be the most significant figure in my performing life. His name was Bill McEwen, and he was the older brother of my high school friend John McEwen. John, a musician since the ninth grade, had joined a group, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and Bill, who aspired to be a show business entrepreneur in the mold of Elvis's Colonel Parker, was managing them. It was simply coincidence that Bill and I had both moved, with intermittent stops, from Garden Grove to Laurel Canyon. Bill had a deep love of early blues, country, and bluegrass music. He would pick up his guitar and sing Jimmy Rogers' line, "He's in the jailhouse now," and snap a string, giving the note a slight percussion. He also spotted genius. At Pepe's, a dinky club in St. Louis, he saw an act called the Almond Joys and brought them to Hollywood. They changed their name to Hourglass, and he represented them for a while before they became the Allman Brothers Band. A few years later, he would create and produce a revered country music album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, for which, it seems to me, everyone gets credit but him, even though Bill dreamed it all up and made it happen. He corralled some recording time for me at those Nashville sessions, after Mother Maybelle Carter, Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs, and Jimmy Martin had gone home for the evening, to lay down some banjo tunes I'd written. In 1981, the songs appeared on my final last gasp comedy album, The Steve Martin Brothers. Bill McEwen was rebellious, defiant, and loved to watch the big guys squirm. After I had achieved success, he said to me, "Right now there are a lot of old-time comedians saying, 'What the fuck?'" He had banged his way out of nowhere, too, living just a few miles from me in Garden Grove and growing up under the thumb of a critical father. He had long hair before it was fashionable and kept it not only after it was unfashionable, but forever. He also loved comedy. We were united in our worship of Johnny Carson, Don Rickles, Steve Allen, and Jerry Lewis. You can hear Bill's laugh buried somewhere on each of my albums. He even came up with one of my staple jokes of the period. "Do you mind if I smoke?" No. "Do you mind if I fart?" We started hanging around together, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, along with his beautiful wife, Alice, who was an excellent photographer. My MGB GT seated two, which meant one of us had to ride in the hatchback trunk, and it was always Bill who, at 6'4", had to curl up like a cat to fit into the car. Bill, after seeing my act 100 times, asked if he could manage me. "What's a manager?" I said. After he explained, I didn't quite understand, and I don't think he did either, but we struck a handshake deal for no other reason than we had nothing to lose. John McEwen, whom I hadn't seen in about a year, came to the house. He had been on the road and grown his hair long, which surprised me, because I was still resisting. He noted my response, stroked his locks, and said, "Part of the business." Soon after, I grew my hair long, and with my earnings from the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, financed a garish collection of turquoise jewelry that I would wear on stage. I was now a full-blown hippie, though not walking around stoned because of my earlier disastrous experience. I riffed on the drug era with this bit, which was delivered in a secretive, low manner. "I'm on drugs. You know what I'm talking about. I like to get small. It's very dangerous for kids because they get really small. I know I shouldn't get small when I'm driving, but I was driving around the other day and a cop pulls me over and says, 'Hey, are you small?' I said, 'No, no, I'm tall, I'm tall.' He says, 'Well, I'm going to have to measure you.' They give you a little test with a balloon, and if you can get inside it, they know you're small. And they can't put you in a regular cell either, because you'll walk right out." The Smothers Brothers Show continued to rankle the brass at both CBS and the federal halls of power. Sketches dealing with race, war, and politics, mixed in with anomalies such as Kate Smith singing God Bless America, made it a hit in the ratings and at the water cooler. It thrived on controversy, but we writers didn't know the level of rancor the brothers were facing. One morning in 1969, I was driving to work when I heard on the radio that the Smothers Brothers Show had been ignominiously axed. Ostensibly, CBS canceled the show because of a late delivery of an episode, but I knew what really had canceled it, a trickle-down from President Nixon. The brothers had surely made Nixon's enemies list, and probably all of us writers had too, and the political pressure must have been too much for lumbering CBS, which didn't need static from the FCC. After the show's demise, our team of eight writers won Emmys, the Academy's defiant response to the CBS brass. But even after this gold-plated recognition, my father still urged me to go back to college so I would have something to fall back on. Comedy was now fully charged with political energy. George Carlin transformed himself from the hippy-dippy weatherman into a true social commentator. So did the volatile Richard Pryor, who dropped the gags, appealed to the underground audience, and used motherfucker as poetic punctuation. Robert Klein was the educated one. You sat in the audience nodding in agreement with his tart observations. After the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour fell, I joined in with my never-miss Nixon jokes. Nixon's best friend is Bebe Rebozo, a name that means to have bozoed again. All I had to do was mention Nixon's name, and there were laughs from my collegiate audiences. Bob Einstein and I had become a solid workhorse writing team. When the Smothers Brothers ended, we continued to get jobs, including the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, which kept me busy for 7 months out of the year. During the hiatuses, I would slog away at my act. Bill had put me on the road, opening the show for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and I am grateful to them because they really didn't need me. We went everywhere. Atlanta, Spokane, Madison, Little Rock, Tallahassee, you name it, I was there. Colleges, clubs, and concert halls in what seemed like every state in the Union. One magical night, on a lonely road in upstate New York, the bus pulled over and we all got out for a stretch of the legs. We looked north into the moonless black sky. Above us, in this low latitude, shimmered the aurora borealis. Mostly, I was alone on these road trips, and I would while away the solitary daytime hours by indulging my growing interest in American art of the 19th and 20th centuries. I haunted museums and galleries, making quick visual checks in the local antique stores in hopes of finding a Winslow Homer that had gone astray. I never did, but I managed to buy a 19th century picture by the English artist John Everett Millais, thinking that I had made the find of the century, only to discover that it was a tired old fake that had been around the art market for years. This was a cheap lesson in my art collecting hobby, which would develop fully a decade later. I also killed time in college libraries, browsing for books on American art. After spotting a rare and valuable book in the stacks at the University of Tulsa, it was Mabel Dodge Lewin's early treatise on Southwestern painting, Taos and Its Artists. I wondered if I could smuggle it past the low-tech librarian, but my better judgment prevailed, and I left it in place. In Los Angeles, there was an exploding number of new afternoon television talk shows. The Della Reese Show, The Merv Griffin Show, The Virginia Graham Show, The Dinah Shore Show, The Mike Douglas Show, and my favorite, The Steve Allen Show. Steve Allen had a vibrant comedy spirit, and if you tuned in, you might catch him playing ping pong while suspended from a crane 100 feet in the air, or becoming a human tea bag by dropping himself in a tank of water filled with lemons. In his standard warm-up for the studio audience, when he was asked, "Do they get the show in Omaha?" Steve would answer, "They see it, but they don't get it." I had developed a small reputation for my appearances at the Ice House, and on May 6, 1969, I wrangled a meeting and auditioned in an office for Steve Allen's two producers, Elias Davis and David Pollock. They accepted me with more ease than I expected, and when I spoke with them afterwards, they commented, "There seems to be a dearth of young comedians right now." I looked puzzled. I said, "That's odd. I don't think there are many at all." Their stares made me realize my blunder. I knew the word, but I had the definition backward. For my first appearance on The Steve Allen Show, which was also my first appearance on television as a stand-up, I wore black pants and a bright blue marching band coat that I had picked up in a San Francisco thrift shop. Steve's introduction of me was ad-libbed perfectly. "This next young man is a comedian, and," he stammered, "at first you might not get it," he stammered again, "but then you think about it for a while, and you still don't get it," stammer, stammer, "then you might want to come up on stage and talk to him about it." The Steve Allen appearance went well. He loved the offbeat, and his cackle was enough to make any comedian feel confident. Seated on the sofa, though, I was hammered by another guest, the Dick Van Dyke Show's Maury Amsterdam, for being unconventional. But I bore no grudge. I was so naive I didn't even know I had been insulted. The Steve Allen credit opened a few doors, and I bounced around all of the afternoon shows, juggling material, trying not to repeat myself. I developed a formula of convenience. If I do a bit on Merv Griffin, which comes on at 2 p.m., it's okay to repeat the material on Virginia Graham, which comes on at 4 p.m. If I do a piece on Steve Allen, which comes on at 5 p.m. on Wednesdays, I can do the same bit on Mike Douglas, which comes on at 3 p.m. on Fridays, or something like that. Through the 3 or 4 years I did these shows, I appeared probably 50 times. I recently viewed a musty video of an appearance on the Virginia Graham show, circa 1970, unseen since its airing. I looked grotesque. I had a hairdo like a helmet, which I blow-dried to a puffy bouffant for reasons I no longer understand. I wore a frock coat and a silk shirt, and my delivery was mannered, slow, and self-aware. I had absolutely no authority. After reviewing the show, I was, especially since I was writing an autobiography documenting my success, depressed for a week. But later, searching my mind for at least one redeeming quality in the performance, I became aware that not one joke was normal, that even though I was the one who said the lines, I did not know what was coming next. The audience might have thought what I am thinking now. Was that terrible, or was that good? From these television appearances, I got a welcome job in 1971 with Ann Margaret, 5 weeks opening the show for her at the International Hilton in Vegas, a huge, unfunny barn with sculptured pink cherubs hanging from the corners of the proscenium. Laughter in these poorly designed places rose a few feet into the air and dissipated like steam, always giving me the feeling that I was bombing. One night, from my dressing room, I saw a vision in white gliding down the hall, a tall, striking woman, moving like an apparition along the backstage corridor. It turned out to be Priscilla Presley, coming to visit Ann Margaret backstage after having seen the show. When she turned the corner, she revealed an even more indelible presence walking behind her, Elvis, dressed in white, jet black hair, a diamond-studded buckle. When Priscilla revealed Elvis to me, I was also revealed to Elvis. I'm sure he noticed that this 25-year-old stick figure was frozen firmly to the ground. About to pass me by, Elvis stopped, looked at me, and said in his beautiful Mississippi drawl, "Son, you have an oblique sense of humor." Later, after his visit with Ann Margaret, he stopped by my dressing room and told Bill and me that he, too, had an oblique sense of humor, which he did, but that his audience didn't get it. Then he said, "Do you want to see my guns?" After emptying the bullets into his palm, he showed us 2 pistols and a derringer. Ann Margaret and her husband, Roger Smith, were, and still are, a fun and generous couple, and they provided me with work when others wouldn't. The next year, they asked if I would open for Ann Margaret at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach. I arrived at the hotel, which at the time was very old world, with an even older clientele. I still had my helmet hair, long black frock coat, and turquoise jewelry, and I'd added a really unattractive beard. Opening night, I peeked at the audience, older Jewish couples. I smelled disaster. Jerry Lewis once described standing backstage before a show and listening to the tone of the audience, concluding, "I knew I was dead." I could hear the echoing rattle of forks on plates and the low, enervated dinner chit-chat. I went on and killed, night after night. I was going over like it was a raucous college campus. Why, I wondered. I was baffled until Roger Smith explained it to me. They look at you in your hippie clothes and beard, and they think, "Aw, it's my son." The Plum television appearance during the 60s and 70s was The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. Bob Shane, who in the late 60s booked The Steve Allen Show, had moved over to The Tonight Show and mentioned me to its producer, Freddie DeCorvita. Bob showed Freddie a kinescope, an expensive 16mm film financed by my bank account, of my appearance on The Steve Allen Show, and Fred replied, "I don't think he's for us." But Bob persisted, and Johnny saw the film and said, "Let's give him a try." To close the deal, I went to NBC one afternoon and auditioned on the soundstage in front of staff and crew while cables were being pulled and cameras were being moved. I was booked on the show in October 1972. There was a belief that one appearance on The Tonight Show made you a star. But here are the facts. The first time you do the show, nothing. The second time you do the show, nothing. The sixth time you do the show, someone might come up to you and say, "Hi, I think we met at Harry's Christmas party." The tenth time you do the show, you could conceivably be remembered as being seen somewhere on television. The 12th time you do the show, you might hear, "Oh, I know you. You're that guy." But I didn't know that. Before the show, as I stood in the backstage darkness behind the curtains of The Tonight Show, hearing the muffled laughter while Johnny spoke and waiting for the tap on the shoulder that would tell me I was on, an italicized sentence ticker-taped through my head. "I am about to do The Tonight Show." Then I walked out on stage, started my act, and thought, "I am doing The Tonight Show." I finished my act and thought, "I have just done The Tonight Show." What happened while I was out there was very similar to an alien abduction. I remember very little of it, though I'm convinced it occurred. I was booked back and did the show successfully several times. I was doing material from my act, Best Stuff First, and after two or three appearances, I realized how little best stuff I had. After I'd gone through my stage material, I started doing some nice but oddball bits, such as Comedy Act for Dogs, first done on Steve Allen, in which I said, "A lot of dogs watch TV and there's nothing really on for them, so call your dog over and let him watch because I think you're going to see him crack up for the first time." Then I brought out four dogs that I can perform to so I can get the timing down. While I did terrible canine-related jokes, the dogs would walk off one at a time, with the last dog lifting his leg on me. The studio audience saw several trainers out of camera range making drastic hand signals, but the home TV audience saw only the dogs doing their canine best. Another time, I claimed that I could read from the phone book and make it funny. I opened the book and droned the names to predictable silence. Then I pretended to grow more and more desperate and began to do retro shtick, such as cracking eggs on my head. I got word that Johnny was not thrilled, and I was demoted to appearing with guest hosts, which I tried not to admit to myself was a devastating blow. I was growing frustrated with writing for television. Although the income was financing my performing career, I was marking time, and the prize of performing regularly on one of the shows was not materializing. I realized that the performers were just using my material as a starting point, and of course, I thought the better joke was to do it as written. On the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, I was thrown the occasional performing bone, appearing as a walk-on with a line or two in a sketch, but I felt no resonance from the producers or audience. There was a baffling moment when Sonny Bono and his partner Dennis Pregnolato, who were becoming showbiz entrepreneurs, approached me at work and took me aside. Sonny and Dennis had seen me perform, I don't know where, and Sonny said, "Steve, we've been watching you. We think you are the next big thing, bigger than David Brenner, bigger than Albert Brooks. We would like to work with you and develop a show for you." I nodded my excitement and never heard from them again, not one word. In the early 70s, I had two memorable auditions. One was for Greg Garrison, the producer of The Dean Martin Show. The audition went like this. I did my act for his secretary, then she did it for Greg. She even borrowed a prop from me to take into his office. My other audition began with a call from a producer who told me about a sitcom pilot called The Fireman's Ball. "They specifically asked for you," he said. I heard the sentence as, "They specifically asked only for you." I practiced the scene, went to the audition, and was surprised to see at least a dozen other young guys marching around a foyer, holding scripts and inaudibly mouthing their lines. I didn't get hired, but the experience was significant for me. I understood I would never be hired in that situation, that the odds of confluence on a certain day of the producer's desires, my talent, and a good reading were low, and that the audition process was a dead end. I decided to leave Hollywood and go on the road. I resigned from television writing against the advice of my agent, a man who had wisely vacuumed up all the young talent discovered by the Smothers Brothers. He said plainly, "Stick to writing," which was a polite way of saying that my performing was headed nowhere. I took this warning with a strange delight. It was, in a way, the necessary ingredient in any young career, like when Al Jolson was told in The Jazz Singer, "Jolie, you'll never become a singer." Bill McEwen had moved to Aspen, Colorado for the skiing, and I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico to escape the Los Angeles smog and traffic. I was 28 years old when a bleak thought occurred to me. What if nothing happens? I had never really imagined success. I was just trying to be a performer, but I could not see myself playing dreary nightclubs into my 30s, 40s, and 50s. I would have struggled composing a real-world resume, as my abilities were at best vague and at worst unusable. I decided to give it until I was 30, and then I would have to figure out something else to do. The Road. My departure from television writing meant that I was now adrift. I had lost my financial support and my hyphen, and now was only a comedian. A club owner in Denver, Chet Hansen, started up a small agency, and even though comedy clubs did not exist yet, he somehow produced wide-ranging bookings that involved planes, trains, and automobiles. For the next few years, I was on the road with an itinerary designed by the Marquis de Sade. There was a sexy anonymity about the travel. I was living the folky myth of having no ties to anyone, working small clubs and colleges in improvised folk rooms that were usually subterranean. However, the travel isolated me. Friends were available only through costly phone calls, and contact with my parents and sister spiraled down to a pinpoint. In this netherworld, I was free to experiment. These out-of-the-way and varied places provided a tough comedy education. There were no mentors to tell me what to do. There were no guidebooks for doing stand-up. Everything was learned in practice, and the lonely road, with no critical eyes watching, was the place to dig up my boldest or dumbest ideas and put them on stage. At night, preoccupied by the success or failure of that evening's show, I would return to my motel room and glumly watch the three TV channels sign off the air at 11:30, knowing that I had at least two more hours of ceiling staring to do before the adrenaline eased off and I could fall asleep. While I toured around the country, Bill had found a Los Angeles agent whom we both adored, Marty Klein. Marty, who loved gold cigarette lighters, fancy eyeglasses, and quality suits, made sure I saw the old-time world of show business before it was gone, taking me to the Brown Derby restaurant in Hollywood, where the walls were lined with celebrity caricatures from the 30s and 40s, and the Sands Hotel in Vegas, where the Rat Pack had cavorted. Bill was also promoting my name to record companies. A recording contract was our quest, though I secretly worried about a record's potential as my act was becoming more and more visual. "And now," I would announce, "my impression of the Incredible Shrinking Man." I would ask the audience to close their eyes for a moment, and when they reopened them, I had raised the microphone several feet. Another bit, I would wonder what it would be like if the human body had only one arm right in the center of our chest. How would we applaud? Putting my elbow in the center of my torso, I would then slap myself in the face a dozen times. I took on an excellent roadie, Maple Byrne, whom I met at a defunct recording studio where he lived in the echo chamber. He was a real deadhead who had to vanish now and then to see a Grateful Dead concert. He booked my travel, set up the props, checked the sound, and ran the lights. Despite his presence, on the road I was fundamentally a loner, withdrawn and solitary. And his introduction of mournful Irish folk music into my life didn't help my mood. We would drive at night from job to job, listening to cassette tapes of the Bothy Band, sad, lonely songs for the sad, lonely road. One of the tunes, The Maid of Cool Moor, inspired a film I wrote 12 years later, L.A. Story. When necessary, I could still manage to have a personality, and sometimes I was rescued by a local girl who actually liked me. Occasionally the result was an erotic tryst enhanced by loneliness. Perhaps the women saw it as I did, an encounter free from obligation. The next day, I would be gone. I had also refined my pickup technique. If I knew I would be returning to a club, I tweaked my hard-learned rule, never hit on a waitress the first night, to never hit on a waitress for 6 months. I came off as coolly reserved, as I would harmlessly flirt on my first visit. By my next visit, everything was in place. Soon the 6 months caught up with me, and I always had someone I could latch onto as I rolled from town to town. I did have interludes of monogamy with a few women. Iris was an aspiring actress who, coincidentally, lived next door, which cut down on travel time for sudden sleepover urges. Chris Gooch, a fragile, ethereal blonde, seemed to float into the club I was playing, the Vanguard in Kansas City, Missouri. We lived together in Los Angeles for a while. Sandy Oliver, her last name described the color of her skin, lived in Atlanta, and we rendezvoused in towns across America. Were they beautiful? We were all beautiful. We were in our 20s. I alternated obscure appearances across America with higher-profile opening act jobs at the Boarding House in San Francisco, the Troubadour in Los Angeles, and the Great Southeast Music Hall in Atlanta, where I first performed with the singer-comedian Martin Mull. Martin's wit was Sahara dry. He performed on stage sitting on living room furniture and sang his own comic songs with titles like Noses Run in My Family, I'm Everyone I Ever Loved, How Could I Not Miss a Girl Your Size, and Jesus Christ Football Star. On opening night at the Great Southeast Music Hall, we were both nervous about meeting each other. I was sitting in my open dressing room when Martin walked by, carrying his stage clothes on a hanger. Unsure whether to say something to me, he kept going. After a few steps, I called out, "Nice meeting you, too." We've been friends ever since. Martin suggested me to his recording label, Capricorn Records. The response from the producer, Phil Walden, was, "Too visual, he's too visual." Later, after my first record shipped platinum, meaning it had already sold 1 million before it was released, Phil called up Martin, "Hey, Mull, you know any more of those visual guys?" In Los Angeles, the Troubadour was my hangout, and the girls did indeed get prettier as closing time neared, or maybe it was I who got prettier to them. The Troubadour's regulars included Michael Nesmith, Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell, Glenn Frey, Don Henley, and all the others whose music was a siren call to a perceptive record executive named David Geffen. One week I opened the show for Linda Ronstadt. She sang barefoot on a raised stage and wore a silver lamé dress that stopped 1 millimeter below her panties, causing the floor of the Troubadour to be slick with drool. Linda and I saw each other for a while, but I was so intimidated by her talent and street smarts that, after the 9th date, she finally said, "Steve, do you often date girls and not try to sleep with them?" We parted chaste. One night I was lingering in the bar and talking to Glenn Frey, who was just leaving his duo, Long Branch Penny Whistle. He said he was considering a name for his new 5-man group. "What is it?" I said. He said, "Eagles." I said, "Oh, you mean the Eagles?" He said, "No, Eagles." I said, "You mean the Eagles?" He said, "No, I mean Eagles." The name of the group remains, of course, Eagles. Mixed reviews continued. At the end of my closing night show at the Troubadour, I stood on stage and took out 5 bananas. I peeled them, put one on my head, one in each pocket, and squeezed one in each hand. Then I read the last line of my latest bad review. Sharing the bill with Poco this week is comedian Steve Martin. His 25-minute routine failed to establish any comic identity that would make the audience remember him or his material. Then I walked off stage. In case I ad-libbed something wonderful, I began taping my shows with a chintzy cassette recorder. I had a routine in which I played a smug party guy with a drink in his hand. When the bit started, the waitresses brought me a glass of wine that I would use as a prop. When that glass was empty, they would bring me another. One night, I listened to the tape, and I could hear myself slurring. I never had a drink before or during a show again. I made another correction based on the tapes. Texas-born and California-raised, I realized I was dropping my ings, runnin', walkin', talkin', and I worked like Eliza Doolittle to elevate my speech. It was a struggle. At first I thought I sounded pretentious and unnatural, but I did it, though now and then I slip back into my natural way of speaking. The consistent work enhanced my act. I learned a lesson. It was easy to be great. Every entertainer has a night when everything is clicking. These nights are accidental and statistical, like lucky cards in poker. You can count on them occurring over time. What was hard was to be good, consistently good, night after night, no matter what the abominable circumstances. Performing in so many varied situations made every predicament manageable, from Toronto, where I performed next to an active salad bar, to the well-paying but soul-killing Playboy clubs, where I was almost but not quite able to go over. But as I continued to work, my material grew. I came up with odd little gags, such as, how many people have never raised their hands before? I was now capable of doing two different 25-minute sets per evening, in case some of the audience stayed over for the second show. Because I was generally unknown, in the smaller venues I was free to gamble with material, and there were a few evenings when crucial mutations affected my developing act. At Vanderbilt University in Nashville, I played for approximately 100 students in a classroom with a stage at one end. I did the show, and it went fine. However, when it was over, something odd happened. The audience didn't leave. The stage had no wings, no place for me to go, but I still had to pack up my props. I indicated that the show had ended, but they just sat there, even after I said flatly, "It's over." They thought this was all part of the act, and I couldn't convince them otherwise. Then I realized there were no exits from the stage, and that the only way out was to go through the audience. So I kept talking. I passed among them, ad-libbing comments along the way. I walked out into the hallway, trying to finish the show, but they followed me there, too, a reluctant Pied Piper. I went outside onto campus, and they stayed right behind me. I came across a drained swimming pool. I asked the audience to get into it, everybody into the pool, and they did. Then I said I was going to swim across the top of them, and the crowd knew exactly what to do. I was passed hand over hand as I did the crawl. That night I went to bed feeling I had entered new comic territory. My show was becoming something else, something free and unpredictable. And the doing of it thrilled me, because each new performance brought my view of comedy into sharper focus. The act tightened. It became more physical. It was true I couldn't sing or dance, but singing funny and dancing funny were another matter. All I had to do was free my mind and start. I would abruptly stop the show and sing loudly in my best lounge singer voice, "Grandpa bought a rubber." Walking up to the mic, I would say, "Here's something you don't often see," and I'd spread my mouth wide with my fingers and leap into the air while screaming. Or invoking a remembered phrase from the magic shop, I would shout, "Uh-oh, I'm getting happy feet," and then dance uncontrollably across the stage, my feet moving like Bala's painting of a futurist dog, while my face told the audience that I wanted to stop, but couldn't. Closing the show, I'd say, "I'd like to thank each and every one of you for coming here tonight." Then I would walk into the audience and in fast motion thank everyone individually. My set lists, written on notepad paper and kept in my coat pocket, were becoming drenched with sweat. The new physicality brought an unexpected element into the act, precision. My routines wove the verbal and the physical, and I found pleasure trying to bring them in line. Each spoken idea had to be physically expressed as well. My teenage attempt at a magician's grace was being transformed into awkward comic grace. I felt as though every part of me was working. Some nights it seemed that it wasn't the line that got the laugh, but the tip of my finger. I tried to make voice and posture as crucial as jokes and gags. Silence, too, brought forth laughs. Sometimes I would stop and, saying nothing, stare at the audience with a look of mock disdain, and on a good night, it struck us all funny. As if we were in on the joke even though there was no actual joke we could point to. Finally, I understood the Cummings quote I had puzzled over in college. Like the burlesque comedian, I am abnormally fond of that precision which creates movement. Precision was moving the plot forward, was filling every moment with content, was keeping the audience engaged. The act was becoming simultaneously smart and stupid. My version of smart was to imbue a hint of conceptualism into the whole affair. My sing-along had some funny lyrics, but it was also impossible to sing along with. My version of stupid, "Oh gosh, my shoelace is untied." I would bend down, see that my shoelace was not untied, stand up and say, "Oh, I love playing jokes on myself." I had the plumber joke, which was impossible to understand even for plumbers. "Okay, I don't like to gear my material to the audience, but I'd like to make an exception because I was told that there's a convention of plumbers in town this week, and I understand about 30 of them came down to the show tonight, so before I came out, I worked up a joke especially for the plumbers. Now, those of you who aren't plumbers probably won't get this and won't think it's funny, but I think those of you who are plumbers will really enjoy this. This lawn supervisor was out on a sprinkler maintenance job, and he started working on a Finley sprinkler head with a Langstrom 7-inch gangly wrench. Just then, this little apprentice leaned over and said, "You can't work on a Finley sprinkler head with a Langstrom 7-inch wrench." Well, this infuriated the supervisor, so he went and got volume 14 of the Kinsley Manual, and he reads to him and says, "The Langstrom 7-inch wrench can be used with a Finley sprocket." Just then, the little apprentice leaned over and says, "It says sprocket, not socket." And I would take a long pause and say, "Were those plumbers supposed to be here this show?" One of my favorite bits to perform evolved at the Troubadour in Los Angeles. After I finished my act, I would go up to the sound booth where there was an open mic out of sight of the audience and say, "They can't hear me out there, can they?" "No," the coach soundman would reply. Then I would say, "What a bunch of assholes. Where can I get some pot?" I would continue my arrogant comments until the bit ran dry. On the road, the daylight hours moved slowly, filled with aimless wanderings through malls and museums. But at night, on stage, every second mattered. Every gesture mattered. The few hours I spent in the clubs and coffee houses seemed like a full existence. When I had new material to try, I would break it down into its smallest elements, literally a gesture or a few words, then sneak it into the act in its shortest form, careful not to disrupt the flow of the show. If it worked, the next night I would add the next discrete packet until the bit either filled out or died. I can remember bailing out of a bit because I didn't want to be trapped in it for the next 5 minutes. The easiest way was to pretend I'd gotten distracted by something and then completely change tack. Around this time I smelled a rat. The rat was the age of Aquarius. Though the era's hairstyles, clothes, and lingo still dominated youth culture, by 1972 the movement was tired and breaking down. Drugs had killed people, and so had Charles Manson. The war in Vietnam was near its official end, but its devastating losses had embittered and divided America. The political scene was exhausting, and many people, including me, were alienated from government. Murders and beatings at campus protests weren't going to be resolved by sticking a daisy into the pointy end of a rifle. Flower power was waning, but no one wanted to believe it yet, because we all had invested so much of ourselves into its message. Change was imminent. I cut my hair, shaved my beard, and put on a suit. I stripped the act of all political references, which I felt was an act of defiance. To politics I was saying, "I'll get along without you very well. It's time to be funny." Overnight, I was no longer at the tail end of an old movement, but at the front end of a new one. Instead of looking like another freak with a crazy act, I now looked like a visitor from the straight world who had gone seriously awry. The act's unbridled nonsense was taking the audience and me on a wild ride, and my growing professionalism, founded on thousands of shows, created a subliminal sense of authority that made the audience feel they weren't being had. Between 1973 and 1975, my one-man vaudeville show turned fully toward the surreal. I was linking the unlinkable, blending economy and extravagance, non-sequiturs with the conventional. I was all over the place, sluicing the gold from the dirt, honing the edge that confidence brings. I cannot say I was fearless, because I was acutely aware of any audience drift, and if I sensed trouble, I would swerve around it. I believed it was important to be funny now, while the audience was watching, but it was also important to be funny later, when the audience was home and thinking about it. I didn't worry if a bit got no response, as long as I believed it had enough strangeness to linger. My friend Rick Moranis, whose imitation of Woody Allen was so precise that it made Woody seem like a faker, called my act's final manifestation anti-comedy. One weekend I was playing at the boarding house in San Francisco, opening for a talented mountain man folk singer named Utah Phillips. My shows went well, very well. I waited for the reviews, but there was scant mention. 5 paragraphs devoted to Utah and a line or two about me. I noticed it in Los Angeles, too, at the Troubadour. Large, thoughtful reviews of the headliner, little or nothing about the opening act. I was learning something about the audience and critics. They aren't there to see the opener. The implied power of the headliner cannot be challenged by a pleasant opening act. But I was not a headliner. I had no following, and I was nearing my arbitrary 30-year cutoff point. I was consistently appearing on TV shows, even The Tonight Show, but what filled folk clubs was underground word of mouth, usually generated by record sales, not late-night TV watchers. I decided to headline only, win or lose. This meant no more boarding house, no more troubadour. It meant that the size of the house I could play would drop significantly. I held firmly to this idea, and within the year, I was completely broke. I called the comedian David Brenner for advice. David was successfully guest-hosting The Tonight Show and filling theaters and clubs. Our paths had crossed, and we had exchanged phone numbers. I explained that I was getting jobs, but the travel cost was killing me. If I got $500 for an appearance, it would cost me $300 just to get to it. He told me the deal he always proposed to club owners. He would take the door, and they would take the bar. He said he would hire someone to stand at the entrance with a mechanical counter to make sure he wasn't being cheated. I didn't have the chutzpah to audit this way, but otherwise it seemed like a fair gambit. I wanted to either get in or get out of the business. I would be paid according to how many people I drew, and that satisfied my Protestant inclination to earn my keep. I proposed this deal immediately to an amenable club owner. After all, he didn't have to put any money up front. And in October of 1973, I got a job at Bubba's in Coconut Grove, Florida, now vanished into the folky sinkhole. It held about 90 people, seated in the worst configuration a club could have. Directly in front of the stage were seats for about 10, extending to the performer's right were the other 80 seats. There was no depth at all, and most of the audience saw only a side view of the performer. These lopsided arrangements were never conducive to laughter, because the audience couldn't quite unite. I arrived a day early, in time to see the closing night of another performer, a comedian who, at least in the show I saw, lifted a line or two from Lenny Bruce. Doing other people's material was on my taboo list, but he was a nice guy and still funny, and when we met after the show, he knew that I knew that he knew that I knew, but we ignored it. The next night I opened, and business was slow. However, I was ready to put my experience at Vanderbilt into effect. The Florida night was balmy, and I was able to take the audience outside into the street and roam around in front of the club making wisecracks. I didn't quite know how to end the show. First, I started hitchhiking. A few cars passed me by. Then a taxi came by. I hailed it and got in. I went around the block, returned and waved at the audience, still standing there, and drove off and never came back. The next morning, I received one of the most crucial reviews of my life. John Huddy, the respected entertainment critic for the Miami Herald, devoted his entire column to my act. Without qualification, he raved in paragraph after paragraph, starting with, "He parades his hilarity right out into the street," and concluded with, "Steve Martin is the brightest, cleverest, wackiest new comedian around." Oh, and the next night the club owner made sure all tabs had been paid before I took the audience outside. Roger Smith had told me that when he came to Hollywood from El Paso to be an actor, he had given himself 6 months to get work. The time elapsed, and he packed up his car, which was parked on Sunset Boulevard, where his final audition would be. Informed that he was not right for the job, he went out and started up his car. He was about to pull away, away to El Paso, when there was a knock on his windshield. "We saw you in the hall. Would you like to read for us?" the voice said. He was then cast as the star of the hit television show 77 Sunset Strip. My review from John Huddy was the knock on the window, just as I was about to get in my car and drive to a metaphorical El Paso, and it gave me a psychological boost that allowed me to nix my arbitrarily chosen 30-year-old deadline to re-enter the conventional world. The next night and the rest of the week, the club was full, all 90 seats. 3,000 miles away, Bill McEwen took the review and waved it in the face of every record executive in Hollywood, with no bites. I continued to appear on The Tonight Show, always with a guest host, doing material I was developing on the road. Then I got a surprise note from Bob Shane. "We had a meeting with Johnny yesterday, told him you'd been a smash twice with guest hosts, and he agrees you should be back on with him, so I think that hurdle is over." In September 1974, I was booked on the show with Johnny. This was welcome news. Johnny had comic savvy. The daytime television hosts, with the exception of Steve Allen, did not come from comedy. I had a small routine, suggested by my writer friend Michael Elias, that went like this. "I just bought a new car. It's a prestige car, 65 Greyhound bus. You know you can get up to 30 tons of luggage in one of those babies? I put a lot of money into it. I put a new dog on the side. And if I said to a girl, do you want to get in the back seat? I had like 40 chances, etc. Not great, but at the time it was working. It did, however, require all the pauses and nuance that I could muster. On the Merv Griffin show, I decided to use it for panel, meaning I would sit with Merv and pretend it was just chat. I began. I just bought a new car, 65 Greyhound bus. Merv, friendly as ever, interrupted and said, now why on earth would you buy a Greyhound bus? I had no prepared answer. I just stared at him. I thought, oh my God, because it's a comedy routine. And the bit was dead. Johnny, on the other hand, was the comedian's friend. He waited. He gave you your timing. He laid back and stepped in like Ali, not to knock you out, but to set you up. He struggled with you, too, and sometimes saved you. I was able to maintain a personal relationship with Johnny over the next 30 years, at least as personal as he or I could make it, and I was flattered that he came to respect my comedy. On one of my appearances, after he had done a solid impression of Goofy the cartoon dog, he leaned over to me during the commercial and whispered prophetically, you'll use everything you ever knew. He was right. 20 years later, I did my teenage rope tricks in the movie Three Amigos. Once Johnny joked in his monologue, I announced that I was going to write my autobiography, and 19 publishers went out and copyrighted the title Cold and Aloof. This was the common perception of him, but Johnny was not aloof. He was polite. He did not presume intimate relationships where there were none. He took time, and with time grew trust. He preserved his dignity by maintaining the personality that was appropriate for him. Johnny enjoyed the delights of split-second timing, of watching a comedian squirm and then rescue himself, of the surprises that can arise in the seconds of desperation when the comedian senses that his joke might fall to silence. Johnny was inclined toward the sciences, especially astronomy, and his Nebraskan pragmatism and knowledge of magician's tricks guaranteed that the occultists, future predictors, spoonbenders, and mind readers never left his show without a challenge. He knew the difference between the pompous ass and the nervous actress and who should receive appropriate consideration. He enjoyed the unflappable grannies who sewed log cabin quilts, as well as the Vegas pro who machine-gunned the audience into hysterical fits. Johnny hosted authors, children, intellects, and nitwits, and treated them all well, and he served the audience with his curiosity and tolerance. He gave each guest, like the ideal America would, the benefit of the doubt. You're nuts, but you're welcome here. For my first show back, I chose to do a bit I had developed years earlier at the Ice House. I speed-talked a Vegas nightclub act in 2 minutes. Appearing on the show was Sammy Davis Jr., who, while still performing energetically, had also become a historic showbiz figure. I was whizzing along, singing a 4-second version of Ebb Tide, then saying at lightning speed, Frank Sinatra, personal friend of mine, Sammy Davis Jr., personal friend of mine, Steve Martin, I'm a personal friend of mine too, and now a little dancing. I started a wild flail, which I must say was pretty funny, when a showbiz miracle occurred. The camera cut away to a dimly lit Johnny, precisely as he whirled up from his chair, doubling over with laughter. Suddenly, subliminally, I was endorsed. At the end of the act, Sammy came over and hugged me. I felt like I hadn't been hugged since I was born. This was my 16th appearance on the show, and the first one I could really call a smash. The next day, elated by my success, I walked into an antique store on La Brea. The woman behind the counter looked at me. Are you that boy who was on The Tonight Show last night? Yes, I said. Yuck, she blurted out. Breakthrough. I did have a tiny bit of drawing power, generated through my daytime television appearances and my growing presence on The Tonight Show, but mostly my name was a rumor. My dubious status as a headliner led me to a tiny pie slice of a folk club in Greenwich Village, the Metro. Now I had an opening act. Still, no one showed up to see me in a new duo, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks. I told the club owner that he could let me go if he wanted, that I wouldn't hold him to his contract. He said he wanted me to stay, until the next night, when again no one showed up. We parted with a handshake. In March 1975, my agent Marty Klein secured a job in San Francisco, 2 weeks headlining the Playboy Club for $1,500 per week. A big payday, and I was desperate for money. Playboy clubs always made me nervous. I never seemed to do well in them, but I had no choice. Opening night was on a Monday, which was already unusual. Clubs were